Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. The topic of this, the 30th installment of Periodical Radio, is Utney Reader. Launched in 1984 by Eric Utney, the magazine's purpose is to present the best of the alternative press. This illustrated monthly anthology is a convenient and attractive way to read stories not found in the mainstream media. To learn more about the past, present, and future of Utney Reader and the alternative press, my guest today is editor David Shimke. Well, David, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Eric Utney founded the magazine in 1984. Can you tell us a little about Eric and what his vision was for Utney Reader?
Sure thing. Eric is, we have an issue that we do every year called Top Visionaries, and I consider Eric to be one of those visionaries. He's a philanthropist, but he's also a social activist. And he had an idea to start, this actually started as a newsletter, and the idea at the time was to give people an opportunity to see a sampling of all the small press and independent media that was taking place around the country that you couldn't get at your local newsstand. So it really started out as a Reader's Digest of sorts of the alternative media. And it's interesting now that we see what's going on with the internet, because there's all these places that people go to sift through various publications, all these portals. And really, long before the internet, it was sort of your first alternative press portal that took place in print. And the magazine took off very quickly. There were two or three of these newsletter-like publications, and they pretty quickly moved into a magazine mode because they saw that they could make some money with it and keep it sustainable. And in the early 90s, it really took off. If you look back at that time, there's press clippings in every major newspaper, and that's when Utney Reader, the name itself, became a really popular one. And at one point, I think it was the top recognized brand for progressive media was Utney Reader. I think it's still in the top 5 or 10, actually. But one of the things that he added to just the digest element, which was, the digest element really was, you know, they were filters. The editors functioned as filters. As the magazine matured into the early 90s, it became a magazine about looking for trends and getting ahead of the mainstream press, because you were seeing all these stories bubbling up and all these movements bubbling up in the alternative media and the independent media on the ground at the grassroots. And so the magazine, a national publication like Utney Reader, was combining sources and recognizing some fairly big trends. Like, for instance, one of the things Eric recognized long before it got any national media attention was that there was an emerging men's movement, and he got on top of that. So that's really how the magazine got started and began to mature.
I see that Eric is still recognized as founder on Utney's masthead, and he contributed a column in the November-December 2008 issue. What's his role today at the magazine?
I'm really excited because he hasn't really been directly involved for a while. Nina Rothschild Utney, who at the time that she was running the magazine was married to Eric, took the magazine over from Eric and ran it for a while. And so his name stayed on the masthead, I think, more just in terms of being in, it's kind of an honorarium. But in the last couple of years now, Eric and I have gotten to know each other really well and spent time together. He's just a great resource and a great ambassador for the magazine. And we'll probably talk about this a little bit during our time together. But the magazine is much more resembles what Eric started out doing more than it has for a few years. And so I think he's very happy with it. And he's agreed to write a column for us every other issue, which I'm very excited about, and he's also going out and speaking about the magazine, and we're going to be putting together an editorial advisory board in 2009, and he'll be on that. So he's involved as a consultant and in spirit, and just on a practical level, he and I get together for coffee every 4 or 5 weeks and just brainstorm and talk about the magazine.
So David, go ahead and tell us some about how the content is returning more to the original roots.
Sure. There was a feeling in the late 90s and moving into 2000, that because of the internet, the digest element of the magazine wasn't as valuable or somehow was going to get, you know, sort of overshadowed. And so a number of things happened when Nina took over the magazine. I think wisely, initially, they chose to sort of focus more on it as a progressive lifestyle magazine and more of sort of a social activist handbook. So it was less of a digest and more of a, I guess I would compare it more to sort of a magazine like you'll see on the newsstand, like Plenty, that actually just went out of business, but Plenty or Good or Yes, magazines that were sort of very friendly to the activist community and kind of functioned as a handbook. I really think that at that point, the magazine's personality got a little bit washed out. There was some confusion among the readership about what we really were, and I think it watered down what we did best. So 3 years ago now, 3 years ago, March, Nina sold the magazine to an entity called Ogden Publications, which is based in Kansas. And Ogden owns Mother Earth News and Natural Home Magazine. And at the time that we were sold, we had reached a point where it was fairly clear that we weren't going to be able to sustain the magazine any longer. So Ogden took us under their wing, and they've been fabulous. They left Nina on as a consultant early on. Not only did they love what we do, but they really encouraged us to really take some chances and do what we thought was best for the magazine, regardless of the economic ramifications, because they had the strength and the backing to sort of prop us up for a while. And so in meeting with the publisher there and editorial director, Brian Welch, we both agreed, both because it was my strength as an editorial person and also because we both agreed that Utney Reader really, at its best, represented this digest-like quality, the best of the alternative press. So we shifted back to that about 2.5 years ago, and I'm proud to say at this point that we've really, I think, reestablished ourselves as a beacon for independent media and alternative media. So it's a little bit harder news, a lot more sources, a lot more, again, celebrating the publications in our library. We have about 1,200 publications that come through our library every month. And I think we saw our circulation drop, and now we're seeing it solidify. We're really doing well online, and I'm really proud of it. I come from, my background is in alternative media. I was a reporter and columnist and editor at the Alternative Weeklies. And so it's much more true to what I think is important right now.
You still have some content that's written by your editorial staff, correct?
Yes, and in fact, I should clarify just the fact that we are pushing more toward that digester, that sort of celebration of the alternative media, doesn't mean that we're all completely going to be reprint. I think it's probably about 60% to 70% reprint and 30% original work. But even that reprint work, the work we do as editors is taking large pieces or several pieces and stitching them together, putting together what we call multi-source items in the front of our magazine, where we'll see a trend developing, say, in the desertification of certain parts of the world. And so we'll have a freelance writer or a staff writer go out and do research and turn to all the journals and periodicals that we're seeing come through the library, do some original interviews on their own. So it's sort of a hybrid of original journalism and source journalism from other periodicals. And we do that throughout the magazine. We also do some freelance assignments where we'll send a freelance writer and photographer out just to do something that we find interesting that we know our readers will like. For instance, in the March-April issue, we have this wonderful story about a Native American tradition that's evolved around gay and lesbian, transgender individuals, a Native American celebration. And we sent a freelance photographer out to shoot that story and a writer out to do the reporting. So again, it's a hybrid, and we do a little bit of both.
Do you ever accept unsolicited manuscripts or pieces that haven't been published previously?
We do, actually. Absolutely, when it comes to freelance pitches, because our goal as a magazine is to be in front of the mainstream media and to spot things. And so if I get a good story that comes through my queue, I definitely tune into it. And then, of course, we get manuscripts that are either in the works or maybe they have an agent or a publisher, but it hasn't yet been published, and we sometimes will excerpt from those things as well.
For the stories that have been published, how does the copyright work on that reprinted material? Do you have to negotiate a permission with the publisher for each article, or do you have a standard that you follow?
We actually have to do each article individually. There's an associate editor here named Julie Hannes who does a lot of that work. And we've always had, actually, the history of the magazine, there's always been an editor that spends a fair bit of time working on that. It really depends on the piece. Some magazines own the work, and so you negotiate directly with the magazine. Some freelance contracts or contracts with writers have the writer owning the work, and so we negotiate with them. So it really varies, and the price varies. What we find is that we're able to get the work relatively affordably, in large part because we celebrate the work. So if it's the publication, for instance, not only do we reprint the piece, but we do a little write-up about the magazine that it's from. We feature them online, and for the writers too. A lot of times we're reprinting, oftentimes if not always, my goal is to always be printing from lesser known publications. So they're usually publications with a smaller circulation. So it's usually a little easier to negotiate those rights than it would be to, say, negotiate rights with Andrew Sullivan or somebody like that, if we wanted to reprint a piece that initially appeared in The Atlantic or something, that would be more expensive. But we will do that too at times. If we find something really strong, we'll pay a little bit more for it. But Julie's great, and she, you know, we have a certain budget that we work with each issue, and we just stitch together what we need to and try to hit that number.
Does Julie ever run into a problem where it's not a problem getting, say, the permission for the text, but there's a difficulty with the illustrations or the photography?
Actually, yeah, we actually have to negotiate that separately in most cases. If it's a publication, sometimes we can get rights to the artwork, but we actually do most of our artwork originally. So if it's a piece that we illustrate, our art director, Stephanie Glaros, is really wonderful, and one of the things we like to do in the magazine as well, and the magazine has a reputation for this, is celebrate the work of illustrators and photographers who work in independent and alternative media. So we actually go out and contract our own illustrators. There will be an occasion where an illustration with a piece is just so perfect and so great, we want to run it, so then we negotiate those rights, and then sometimes we'll negotiate it individually with the photographers. But one thing you'll find is that photographers and illustrators typically do have a little bit different contract with magazines than writers. They're a little less, they're not as broad, and mm-hmm. So typically you have to do a little bit extra negotiation to get a hold of that work. But usually, the amazing thing about Julie is I've been here working with her now as editor for a little over 3 years, and I've been at the magazine for almost 6 years now, and there's only been like one or two occasions where we haven't been able to get something.
David Utney Reader is billed as the best of the alternative press, but some recently reprinted articles come from what I would consider the mainstream, like Columbia Journalism Review and Foreign Policy. What qualifies as alternative for Utney?
It's a fairly broad definition. I think what we try to do is almost always focus on publications, again, that aren't as available or a little bit smaller. Where we will sort of push that is when we find something that we think is so important or so well done that we want to get it in front of as many people as possible. So, for instance, a Columbia Journalism Review is a little bit more mainstream, as is Foreign Policy, but their raw circulation numbers aren't that high. So our sense as a staff is that the information that we're imparting is of such great importance and so well done that we need to sort of push the boundaries of those rules a little bit. With book publishers, we do really try hard not to reprint from publishers over a certain size. We really try to stick with smaller houses. It's just been that way really since the beginning when I've looked back at older magazines. And it's something that, believe it or not, we actually spend a lot of time talking about around here. So if somebody does pitch something from a bigger publication, we go round and round in trying to decide whether or not the standards are higher when we choose to do that.
Utney has its own library with a full-time librarian, right?
Yes.
It's Danielle Mastretti.
Yes, that's correct.
Does she simply collect and organize the collection, or does she have a larger role at the magazine?
She has a much larger role. Everyone here is a multitasker. We put out the magazine with five people. And if you add the art department, there's seven. And Danielle's one of those people. So everyone's involved in planning the magazine. And actually, at this magazine in particular, the librarian role is so key because we are sifting through so many publications and reprinting and repurposing. And so Danielle is really one of the key actors in getting the best stuff in front of us. She also does a column for the magazine where she tries to go out and see how certain stories are being covered in the alternative press. For instance, she did a column about how prison reform is being covered. She did a column about Iraqi refugees. And she turns to these smaller publications and tries to tell our readers what they're missing or what they could see if they looked that way. And one of the ways we work as a group is we meet. We're a little bit different editorial operation in the sense that we operate really as a democracy. I mean, at the end of the day, I have to make some decisions and some calls in terms of the mix of what goes in the magazine. But we spend a lot of time as a group debating and passing around ideas and Danielle is a key member of that group as well. I tell people that we're less like a newsroom environment, where I have worked in newsroom environments. We're less like a newsroom environment and almost more like a little think tank, because we just spend so much time together sifting through all this great information and trying to decide, you know, what are the best few things that we can present to our readers each issue.
I would suspect that Utney Readers Library has one of the best collections of alternative publications really in the world. Is the collection used for any purposes other than supporting the magazine?
It's open to folks. We're actually in the process of trying to advertise a little bit more to our local community here in Minneapolis that they should come use it. But yeah, it's open to the public. And Danielle has relationships with a number of people in other libraries where she'll trade publications. You'll find that other independent magazines and alternative magazines are aware of the library and will turn to Danielle. So yeah, it's used more broadly. And I think you're right. I think it's one of the best libraries of its kind. The other thing that Danielle does, because we do have limited space, at some point, especially with our books, we'll run out of space and we have to do something with those books. So we have a couple programs going with public libraries in smaller towns and in rural areas. And so we'll have librarians come up here from greater Minnesota and western Wisconsin and take some of these books and back to their communities.
Tell us about the Utney Independent Press Awards. What are they and why are they important?
Oh, what a great time to ask that. We're in the midst of picking our nominees. It's a really intense process. It's a lot of fun. We feel like in terms of being an ambassador for the independent press and doing what we can to support smaller publications is really, really key. These publications really benefit from the recognition, and they use it in their advertising material and their circulation material, and they tell us that it helps. The whole idea is that because we do count on these other magazines really as the intellectual engine for the magazine, we need to point to the best ones each year. We typically have between 10 and 12 categories. They shift a little bit from year to year, but they're fairly consistent. And then we try to have 8 nominees per category, and that's usually whittled down from, I'm not exaggerating, 30, 40 magazines that start in each category. But I think, you know, hopefully for the reader benefit, the peer reader benefit, is for people to see that in categories like politics and environmental coverage, there's magazines and journals that are doing work that's above and beyond what they're seeing in the mainstream media, and we want to make sure they know about it, because a lot of this stuff is accessible at their newsstand or at their bookstore, or they can order these magazines. So we think it's a great resource for our readers in that regard. And for the magazines that we recognize specifically, like I say, I think it's a good feather in their cap. They get really excited about it. You know, a lot of these folks are toiling away for very little money or no money at all. And just getting that sort of recognition and getting their name out to 250,000 readers is a big boost for them. And it just makes us feel good about promoting their work.
Well, you mentioned very little money or no money at all. I read a lot of dire reports about the financial future of magazines and newspapers. Is the independent press in trouble?
Yes, it is. There's just so much, especially now. I mean, it's just a double whammy, because you have a shift to more readership online and advertisers not knowing exactly where to go. And then, of course, on top of that, nobody's really come up with a really great way to monetize things online, especially editorial content. So that's tough. And then you add on top of that this extreme economic downturn that we're in the middle of. And a number of magazines closed this year. You know, it's interesting. I'm seeing that some of the bigger magazines and the mainstream media is struggling even more. And I'll try not to get too wonky, but one of the interesting things about that is that bigger magazines like a Time and a Newsweek or a Rolling Stone, their whole circulation strategy or their whole economic strategy is built around building up circulation. They build up as, you know, they get this huge circulation of millions of people, and then they sell that circulation to the advertiser. And they say, look at all the issues that are out there. Here's the people you're going to reach. And in some sense, that circulation is false. A lot of that circulation is given away. Some of it's purchased. Again, I won't get too wonky, but there's all sorts of expensive ways to manipulate that data and make yourself look really big. The minute that advertising starts to fall off at all, which is what's happened now, that huge circulation cost really nails these companies. And so you see magazines losing tons of money, cutting staff, going away altogether. Some of the smaller independent magazines, and magazines like Utney Reader as well, where the circulation is, you know, oftentimes around 20, 30,000, 50,000, or in the case of some of the bigger magazines like Us and Mother Jones, which are in the hundreds and 200s of thousands, it's a lot of magazines, obviously, but we're not selling circulation to our advertisers. We're selling an audience. we're telling people, hey, you know, there may be only 70,000 people reading our magazine, but there are people who really love the magazine. They go out of their way to buy it. So you're seeing that some of the smaller magazines are having a little bit better time, assuming they were healthy going in, which is a big assumption because a lot of them are always, you know, operating on a shoestring. So any sort of deviation is going to hurt them. In terms of what's going to happen, it's really up in the air. It's a tumultuous, scary, and at the same time sort of interesting period to be in this business, because I think things are going to really shake out in the next 18 to 24 months in a number of areas of the media, daily newspapers, smaller magazines, bigger magazines, internet, the radio, even television to a certain degree. I think one of the things that print media still has going for it is that tactile experience that people enjoy, the portability, and also it's one of the few mediums, magazines are one of the few mediums now that are sort of filterless. You know, if you're watching TV, you can use your DVR and skip through commercials. If you're online, you can set filters online. And if advertisers at least want to get an idea or an image in front of people, print is still a way that, you know, you can't erase a page. You're going to at least turn by it. And so the goal of the advertiser is to catch people's attention. So that might help print media out a little bit. I also think you're going to see more and more magazines like an e-reader and The Nation and Mother Jones adopt a nonprofit or foundation model so that they can continue to do the hard journalism that's not necessarily popular with people or doesn't build huge audiences, but is really important. As a side note, I'll just say, as a, you know, outside the realm of publishing and being an editor, as a citizen, I have some concerns about what's happening in the media right now, because the first thing that's being cut and the last thing that's being invested in when things start to go a little bit better is the news gathering operations themselves. And that's really problematic. There's less and less reporters being paid a living wage to go out and dig up stories. I love the blogosphere and I love citizen journalism, but it's a very reactive sort of journalism. It's not an investigative or in-depth sort of reporting. And you need people out there that can do that and can get paid to do that. And so I worry as a citizen about the quality of our information and where exactly it's going to come from, because if these daily newspapers start to close the way it looks like they're going to, or really minimize their staff, you know, a lot of these internet portals and people blogging, at the end of the day, they're depending upon the work that's coming out of these newsrooms. And so once that work goes away, I'm going to be curious to see what happens to, you know, to democracy itself.
David, you mentioned that Ogden Publications bought Utney Reader in 2006. What was it like for you as editor to make that transition?
It was a really intense time. I was at a publication that was purchased and closed several years ago. I was at another publication where ownership changed sort of in the middle of the night. And then this situation, which was a friendly purchase, the due diligence process took place over a three-month period. Nina Utney and Brian Welch, the publisher and editorial director that I mentioned before, had a great working relationship. They spent a lot of time in each other's offices sort of figuring out how to make this work. So, you know, in terms of just the practical shift, you have all those normal anxieties, like who's going to keep their job, is the staff going to downsize, you know, what's really going to happen, what's really the goal here, is this company true to our mission. Once I got to know those folks, I was really confident that they believed that our mission squared with theirs. And then once the actual shift took place, I have to tell you, you know, it sounds like, I've told this to a couple publications over the last couple of years, and I always preface it by saying I know it sounds like, you know, sort of PR BS, but the truth of the matter is I can't imagine a smoother transition. I feel really lucky because in Minneapolis there's been a number of buyouts and closings and shifts in ownership, and a lot of that stuff gets really ugly. And this company just basically came in and said, hey, we really love you guys. We love what you're doing. We know you've really been struggling, so we want to give you some more resources and see if we can make this thing break even and eventually get profitable. We're still working on that. But, you know, a lot of times when there's a buyout like this, content gets softer or it gets more sort of generated to please a certain audience. And almost the exact opposite happened here, which was the publisher really agreed with us that we needed to be challenging, that we needed to push the envelope a little bit, that we need to really be true to the spirit of alternative media, which is to be fearless and question things across the spectrum. It's been pretty amazing. And I can tell you that without them, I don't think we'd be here anymore. So it's just been a really good marriage so far.
Well, David, on that note, we need to conclude.
Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you very, very much. An individual annual subscription to Utney Reader is $12. Thank you for listening to Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.